show business. That's what's coming up on the Art of Bombing, episode 223.
The following podcast was previously recorded as a live stream broadcast. If you would like to tune in to a future episode of the Art of Bombing Live, please follow us on Facebook, Twitch, YouTube, or visit our website, artofbombingpod.com.
My friend Dan, he's got a podcast, 'cause all comics need a podcast, and nobody had a podcast called The Art of Bombing. So Dan went out and bought a tape deck. Who knows why he bought a tape deck? Podcasts don't get played on tape decks, but Dan is from the 80s. So hey there, all you funny jerks, come talk to Dan about your work. Tell him all about your worst times. It's The Art of Bombing.
Welcome to a brand new live episode of the Art of Bombing podcast. I'm your host, Dan Bublich Jr., and with me as always is my co-host slash producer, Josh Shirley. How's it going, Josh?
Oh, it's good, man. I went sledding today.
You went sledding. Oh, that sounds fun.
Great. Not only is it fun, but it just kind of creates this antithesis between my life and all the adult things you're doing. I'm moving to a different city. I'm getting married. All those types of things.
I know, right? And it's getting real, too, because the movers come tomorrow to start packing all our stuff. And then Tuesday, they're loading up. So it's like, oh, man, I've got, like, I'm surrounded by all the stuff in my studio that I've got to, like, keep with me versus what I got to get ready to for them to pack up. It's getting real. Right. Getting real, real.
Dude, moving sucks.
It does suck. You know, I would rather have went sledding today, except, I don't know, how cold is it in Kansas City? Up here, it's like minus 10.
All right. So we're doing better than that. We're about 18 right now.
Yeah, that's good sledding weather. Way better than what it is here, that's for sure.
That's right. That might actually kill you.
It's... you're not wrong at all. Yeah. If you're out sledding in this, it's probably going to be a cold day. Cold day. Well, yeah, yeah. It's good to see you. This is going to be our one and only live stream for January because of the move. Because I still don't have a home. We're going to be living in a hotel for the month of January. And with living in a hotel, you don't know what you have for internet. It gets to be spotty. Right.
As we learned, a true comedian lives in his car, dude. So
that's right.
Good for you. Must be nice living in a hotel.
It's that fiance that I got. She's the one that's thanks to her, we get to sleep in a hotel and not my car. If it was up to me, we'd be in the car, and she probably wouldn't be with me anymore, though. So it's probably a good thing that we're sleeping in the car.
That's right. So next stop is a house. That's why I'm in a house most of the time. I'm married. So fiance, you're engaged, you get to sleep in a hotel. You get married, you sleep in a house. You're working your way up.
That's right. You got it. That's how you survive as a comedian, is find somebody that can support you, right? No. Don't let her hear that. She'll kick me out.
Box checked. Well, you know, if she listens to the podcast, you know.
She doesn't. I know that for a fact. She hears enough of my BS in regular time. She doesn't need to listen to podcasts. She listens to a lot of true crime podcasts. She's learning about how she can get rid of me without any evidence. That's what we got going on here.
My wife listens to the podcast. She just won't listen to my episode of the podcast.
Nah, that's funny. She's that's
working
funny.
Around that one.
That's hilarious.
She's like, I know what happened.
got the pup in the background. Did you have a good New Year's?
I did. I went to sleep at about 8:45, and I woke up the next day at 6. It's, you know, that's just where I'm at, Dan.
Like, hey, I get it.
It's not all balls to ball partying for me.
If had I not had any shows, I probably would have been in bed pretty early myself. But I had a couple shows. That's what kept me out. And even with those shows, I brought in the new year driving my car home to go hang out with my dogs. It struck midnight while I was in my car on my way home.
That's right. Well, we're two middle-aged guys on a podcast, so what else are we going to talk
exactly.
about other than I fell asleep by the fireplace with my book.
Yeah, just a couple of cool cats. Well, we've got a great episode today. I'm very excited. This is our first live episode of 2022, and we're kicking it off strong. We've got a fantastic guest. Our guest today is Dobie Maxwell, a legend in comedy, and especially in the Midwest. And you know, there's a lot of comics. If you ask them if they've heard of Dobie Maxwell, they've heard of Dobie Maxwell. This guy has done and seen it all. You know, he's got a career 30 plus years. He's got a fantastic comedy group that he admins. That great, great comedy insight. He's always writing tips, giving advice. He teaches comedy, so we're in for a real treat to kick off 2022.
I'm ready to learn, man. This guy has been around doing this since 1985. He told us that he used to book wrestling.
Book wrestling. I know. I lit up when he said that. I was like, what?
Man, this is going to be a good time. Just some of the credits that he has. Some of the comedians that he's open for are dead.
I shouldn't laugh at that. I mean, that sounds. It sounds sad, but it's also kind of humorous.
That
just
means
because,
he's a legend.
Yeah, exactly. He's been around. He outlasted them. That's how long, that's, exactly. He's outlasted
it's
them.
The Grim Reaper of comedy.
Okay, let's not get that far, because this could be our last then. No, if you don't put that energy on our guest. Take that
I'm
back.
I'm voting for him right now. That means I'm next.
Let's hope not. Before we bring him in, if you're, take care of some business, make sure wherever you're watching or wherever you listen to the podcast, make sure you follow, subscribe, give us that 5-star rating, give us that review. Do those things. Share the show with your friends. Help spread the show. That helps get us, you know, more downloads. Helps us get in the algorithms. We get to beat the system. More people find the podcast. That's just good for everybody. And then real quick, we did have a comment from the Facebook group. This came from Drake Strong in our Facebook group. He says that he's at a hockey game right now with his son, but wanted to say hi to Dobie. Greetings from Sioux City, and he'll catch the replay. So that's cool. Shout out to Dobie already. All right, well, unless you have anything, I don't have anything else. I think we should get into this kick butt interview we're about to do.
This is going to be a good time, man. I can't wait to see this. Can't wait to see the soundbite, hear the jokes. This is going to be fun, man. So excited about it.
Here we go.
And now it's time for the stand-up soundbite.
Making his national TV debut, Dobie Maxwell, everybody. Dobie Maxwell. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Greg. Thank you. I cannot tell you how delighted I am to be here with you today. This is the best part of my entire day. The few minutes I get to stand here telling you what went wrong. Welcome to my nightmare. Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're going to like it. If no one, someone else, somehow, somewhere, somebody is doing worse than you, that makes your day. I can make your month. I can make your spring. You know, I have the worst luck of anybody walking the face of the earth. Look at me as your one-man self-esteem stimulus package. Is what it is. It's the thing. Luck is everything. Every day in my life is Friday the 13th mixed together with the Ides of March, and there's always a full moon, and there is no escape. Nobody has luck like me. Let me give you an example. I'm the only person I know that has run out of gas in a car wash. Twice. In the same week. That's embarrassing. It's humiliating. Standing next to my car, drenched to the bone, yelling at the top of my lungs, come around, come around. Then, of course, I lock my keys in the car, you know, and it's the closing time, and it's a 3-day holiday weekend. My entire life can be summed up in 3 simple words. Worst case scenario. Then, for a little fun, throw in a glitch or a wrinkle or a hiccup, and that's the formula for my life, man. I've been known to get the finger from leprechauns on occasion. Black cats refuse to cross my path. If you're having a bad day, I'll cheer you up, man. I have so many unsolved problems going on in my life at any one time. I got a restraining order from Dear Abby and Dr. Phil. But I'm here to cheer you up. That's the way it goes, man. Things are you're trying to go good. I have the worst luck with cars. Oh, man. One time, I tell you, I was in a police station paying a parking ticket while I was getting a speeding ticket. Does that make sense to you? Another thing happened to me. I was in a fast food drive-thru line, the busiest possible time. My engine blows. What do you do? Worst case scenario, push it 10 feet, wait. Another 10 feet, wait.
Welcome to the show, Domi. That was fantastic.
Oh, nothing is bigger torture than to make a comedian watch his own set.
I know, right? at least it's a good set, right? It's even though it is hard, no matter whether you had a good set or not, it is always hard to watch yourself and or listen to yourself. But at least it wasn't like a bomb. You know what I mean? Like,
well, it's funny that my classes, I play that. I'm not in the same room, but I play that clip, or I tell my students to watch it, and then I tell them everything that I did wrong, up to and including forgetting my joke in the middle of the set. And I had to go back, and it just we could be here for 2 hours talking about how everything that went wrong with that particular set. But Craig Ferguson could not be any nicer. The staff was really great, and it was a good experience.
I'll bet that's really cool. It's really cool that you got to do some late night in your career, and that's I mean, especially, you know, because that was an older clip, but and obviously it with Craig Ferguson because he's no longer the host of the Late Late Show, but that's cool that you got to do that. I mean, that's.
I hope every comic gets to experience that, because I heard a lot of comedians, like Stephen Wright, talked about the first time he did a Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, that his legs were like noodles behind the curtain, and he wanted to be anywhere but there, walking out the tubes. I'm like, well, that's, you know, I did my set 1,000 times, and it's exactly what he said is true. Mm-hmm. I mean, just walking that 10 steps out there, I just felt like I was on Rubber Leg Street, and it was a nightmare. But then you're glad it's over. Leno talked about his first time on the Tonight Show. He said he was glad it's over. It's like sex. It was great when it happened. It's over way too soon. And when you're done, the first thing you want to do is do it right over again.
I believe totally that. That's awesome.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me, too.
Yes, I'm very excited. You've been on my short list for a while. I just haven't had... I'm glad that we finally got it to work out, because I, like I said in our intro, I talked about the Facebook group that you have, your Facebook group that you admin, and it's... For those listening, if you're a comic and you want to get, you know, learn from the pros and learn from legends, because there's a lot of legendary comics in this group outside Adobe, definitely go check out the Maxwell Method of Comedy.
Thank you. I just drive the bus in that whole thing. There's a lot of Jimmy Brogans in it, who was Jay Leno's head writer for a long time. There's just a long list of comedians. Rich Scheidner's in it. So many people that are my idols and heroes. And I decided, you know what? I made every mistake that there was to make when I started off, and there was not a lot of people that helped me. So I always tried to help others just because it was the right thing to do. And I named it the Maxwell Method only because Colonel Sanders did not invent fried chicken, but he was smart enough to put his name and his face on the bucket.
Yep. You know, nope. Branding. That's smart.
Craigslist. Who's Craig? You know, I'm Craig. I'm Maxwell.
No, that's smart. Very smart. And yeah, and like I said, it's a great resource. And as far as like, cause when it comes to Facebook, you never know what, you know, with a lot of those Facebook groups are terrible. They're very toxic and very just, they're not great. And
I don't allow that.
And that's exactly what's great about yours. You don't allow, it's not spammy. There's not negativity. It's, you know, you keep everybody on track. You know, you allow people to promote stuff now and again, but it isn't like constant spam negativity. You're actually getting good information. Cause like you said, there's a lot of great comics in the group. You know, you mentioned Jimmy Brogan, I actually know Jimmy. I worked with him when I lived out in California, which is really cool. He's such a great comic too. And you know, Tom Dresden is another one that's in the group, and who also another legendary comic. And it's just crazy that you can go and kind of network with these comics and interact with these pros. Well,
I'm going to hate to interrupt you, but I want to give you credit too. When you approached me about doing this, you were very polite and very nice. And I'm thinking, that's all I ask is just to be nice. I love what you're doing. I'll promote it. Now you have free reign, for whatever it's worth, to promote anything you do in that particular group. I look at it as the free space on a bingo card. Everything else is out of control. I just want one little place of the internet to go where comics that are serious about getting better.
That's yes.
You don't have to be good. I just want you to be serious about getting better. And we're over, I think, almost 4,500 now.
Oh, wow.
Worldwide. I looked at the statistics, and we're like in Finland. I mean, how many Finland comedy clubs do you know? I have no idea.
Yeah, right.
It's good to have.
Top of my head, none.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
No, that's cool. Great. Well, fantastic. And like I said, it's a great group. So if you are watching or listening to this, you know, depending on where you're consuming this particular episode, go check that out if you want to get better, because like I said, it is a great resource. I've been doing comedy going on my 12th year, and like it's been a great resource for me. I've learned so much because there's so many different comics that are in the group too. Not just, you know, professional legend. There's a lot of road comics that know quite a bit about the business, and you know, it's a great networking resource because everybody's trying to help everybody, giving tips, giving advice, people ask questions, pros answer it, you know, a lot of people, you've been doing the Tuesday tips, which are great, and like I said, and you're very welcoming to the new members and trying to make everybody feel welcome in the group, and I think, yeah, you've done a fantastic job.
Well, thank you very much. If that's my legacy and I have to go, that's okay too. I'm totally cool with that.
You're going to have more. That's more than that's your social media legacy, maybe, but it's definitely not your legacy.
You never know. We're talking about when we get the bombing stories. I am a Hall of Famer when it comes to bombing. I'll tell you that.
Well, I think every comic is a Hall of Famer when it comes to bombing. And if they're not,
I'm not a bragger. I'm above the bomb.
He's like, you just wait when we get to it.
Standard, brother. Yes.
I love it. Well, that's a good lead-in, into the bombing part of it. I would love, like I said, you've been doing comedy for a long time, so I'm sure you've got plenty of stories to talk about. So I would love to hear some of your stories of the times where you felt like you bombed really bad.
Well, let's start with the biggest one that I can remember. It was a place called the Stardome in Birmingham, Alabama. I don't know if you've never heard of the Stardome. If you never, it's a beautiful comedy club, one of the biggest I've ever seen. It probably seats several hundred, maybe 500 people, and it was jam-packed. And it's gone through several bookers through the years, and when I got asked to do it, they had regular headliners. And when you're starting out in comedy in America, you don't realize how regional it is, and especially North and South. A lot of North comics can't work in the South. A lot of South comics can't work in the North, and that's just the way it is. So they said, well, we could put you in the Stardome on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. And that was pretty decent money. And I was working in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm originally from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So Madison, I have a lot of friends there. It's a great comedy town. If you've never worked there before, very smart audiences. I love working in Madison. I said, well, I'm in Madison, Wisconsin on Saturday night, and I have to be in Birmingham on Sunday. And the booker said, do you want the gig or not? With the typical warmth and compassion that all bookers show. So to make a long story longer, it was the middle of summer. I said, yeah, you know what? I can use the money. I will do the gig. Now, here's where the mistake started happening. First off, I had a lot of friends there. I was going to get a nap in on maybe Friday during the day or Saturday during the day. Well, friends, hey, you got to go to lunch with us. And other friends, well, you got to go to dinner with us. And then friends came to the show. Well, you got to hang out with us. So I didn't get any sleep at all. And it's 100 degrees out, and it's after the show. I got to be in Birmingham on Sunday night. It's Saturday night. It's 100 degrees. And I got to Indianapolis, and I slept for about an hour and a half. This all has a point, by the way. So I slept in Indianapolis in a rest area. So I'm driving, and it's hot, and I get to right outside of Nashville, Tennessee, and in my typical comedian's car, the air conditioning blows out. It's 100 degrees out. I'm in Nashville. It's in August. Oh, my God, it's horrible. The energy drains out. And what happened, to make a long story longer, a truck full of logs tips over and clogs the entire freeway system of Nashville, Tennessee. So I got to Birmingham within about 20 minutes of the show. I'd never been there before. This is before cell phones. I couldn't call in. I'm nervous. You know how it is when you don't know if you're going to make the gig or not. Had to take the dry shower, basically wash under the arms, dry shave, comb the hair, go right to the club. It's packed. There's 500 people there on a Sunday night in the middle of summer in Birmingham, Alabama. Wow, this is going to be fantastic. There's a green room there with snacks and cold drinks. This is going to be the best gig I ever had in my life. And I didn't know the other comedians. So the opening act, they're all really nice comedians. The opening act goes up, and he hit on a premise that I did. And he wasn't stealing material. I'm not accusing him of that. But it's one of those things where, hey, he's got some similar ideas, angles. He's kind of a premise. Well, the feature act went up, and he did two of my premises. So now I'm tired. I've been out driving all night. It's hot. I'm sunburned. Now I don't have any premises. I went out there, and it's one of those where I have if you've ever seen my opening, I don't talk 100 miles an hour, which is bad for doing gigs in the South. And I stumbled at my opening is rhythm, and I stumbled on it. So now my opening usually gets applause. It doesn't get applause. The other comics did my premises. So I could just feel myself slide down into the abyss of the bowels of hell. And those people turned on me, and I was a Yankee, and I was a Northerner, and they started booing and throwing stuff and get off the stage. And, of course, I didn't meet the club manager because I got there real close to it. So he wanted to talk to me afterwards. So I had to make my way through the entire crowd as they're walking out, looking at me like, what do we waste our money on? And it was absolutely the fate worse than death. You want to crawl in a hole and die. And the next night I came back, and there was a guy there in the green room. Who are you? Well, I'm going to do a guest set, but I'm going to go on after you. Oh, so you bumped me back down the feature. Oh, no, it's not like that. It's exactly what they did. And, of course, it went fine the next night on Monday. And on Tuesday, I did really well. And the manager said, well, where was that on Sunday night? Well, it wasn't there. And it's just all the stars came together, and I had the worst set of my life. And they're still talking about it to this day. Somebody asked me, and I talked to the booker at the time, and I said, hey, any chance of getting back in the Star Dome, just as a joke? And he said, his quote was, what millennium are we talking here? They hate you.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. And it was just absolutely horrible. And just whatever you're trying, it's just not working. And I don't have anything against Southern people, but they just are not on a wavelength of what I was doing. And I talk fast, and it did not work at all. But I was telling them halfway through the set, I have video in my car of me destroying less than 24 hours ago. Two times, two sets in Madison, Wisconsin. I will give you the video so you can take it home. I really do know what I'm doing. And I'm trying to be fun, and they're just not buying it.
They're not on board with it. Yeah. No. It's amazing how different parts of the country, you know, how some things work and some things don't. Like with, you know, and not just like, you know, regional humor, just being in a different region, like different, you know, there's just like these almost like assumptions about people, or, you know, prejudgments. And so an audience judges you because you're from the North, and then, or whatever. Yep. It's very interesting how that works and how that can affect a set.
Well, comedy is rhythm. It's music. Mm-hmm. It really is. Dick Van Dyke talked about that when they asked him to do a comedy show. He goes, well, I don't know anything about comedy, but I'm a music man, a dance man. I know rhythm, and comedy is rhythm. And it truly is. And people in a certain region are used to talking a certain way and a certain pace and even certain words. I have a bit of that too in my act about, you know, something that where I'm from, it's soda. You know, some places it's pop.
Yeah.
In the South, it's Coke. You want Coke? Yeah. What kind? Sprite?
You know,
that's really true. Yeah.
It is. And so this was even before I did comedy. I went on a trip to Texas with my now ex-wife. Of a while ago, because she had some family in Texas, and we were going down there to visit them, and we had stopped. I believe we were actually in Texas at this time. We stopped to get lunch, and that blew my mind, because I went, you know, I think, you know, I call it soda, pop, whatever, and I went to order, I don't know if I called it a soda or called it a pop, and the waiter was like, you mean a Coke? I was like, no, I don't want a Coke. I want a Dr. Pepper. He's like, oh, you want a Dr. Pepper Coke? And I'm like, what? I was so confused. And he's like, oh, you're not from around here, are you? And I was like, what gave it away? And then he, you know, proceeded to explain that they call them Cokes. They're just different flavors. Like, it's, you know, Coke is
totally
a Coke.
True.
And then there's, like you said, a Sprite. Like,
well, I really think that's why it takes a comic such a long time to develop. You know, a musician can go in their basement or practice, you know, with their other bandmates and go out there and have a show. Comedians, you have to go up there and bomb live in front of strangers. It's one of the first road gigs I ever had. I was just an opening act. And new comedians today, an opening act can't make a living. Well, you could back then. I was in 1986 or seven, making, you know, $350, $400, $500 a week to work a comedy club. And there was a chain called the Punchlines, and they were in the South, and they're open 6 nights a week. So they give you a condo, and you're basically working 6 nights a week at your craft. And there's 2 shows on Friday and 3 shows on Saturday, and that's how you get good. Now I can't imagine that today for young comedians. And that's just how it was back then. And I had a big bit about, now you grew up in the North, about the snow stomp. You know, you come in from outside when you're a kid, and you got to stomp all the snow off of your shoes or your boots in school or at home. And it's just it's a lame bit. But when you start out in comedy, it's just it's like baby teeth. Those are the bits that I had. And I had about maybe 15 or 20 minutes total. Well, I got down in the South on my first road swing, and that was about a 6 or 7 minute chunk, and it didn't snow down there. So I go up there and start doing my snow stomp bit, and you could hear a mouse pee on cotton from 500 yards. It's like I had to come up with. So you learn those things. It takes years to get all that in your head.
Oh, absolutely.
Hard. It's hard, man. It's really, really hard.
Oh, yeah, it is. You're not wrong about that. And yeah, like you said, and that's another thing that's amazing about, like, you know, in the 80s, early 90s, you could be an opening act and make a pretty decent living doing comedy. And now, as an opening act, it's tough, because that's one thing that's always kind of blown my mind about comedy is how in like 30 years, it seems like the pay hasn't really changed unless you become a celebrity of some sort, you know, unless you have drawability and you have something that, you know, help propel your career and you can actually draw a crowd. The pay is just standard everywhere. And it has been for like 30 years.
Yep. You talk about booking pro wrestling. I booked pro wrestling for years, and it's the same. All my wrestler friends complain about the same thing, that they're risking their body, and then none of them can walk at age 40, and they're getting the same money that they were getting 20 and 30 years ago as well. So I think bookers know that performers want to work, and that urge to work a lot of times outshines money. And they'll find somebody. If you don't want the gig for $200, well, there's 25 people behind you that'll take it. They'll stomp on your carcass, stepping over you to take that gig.
Yep. And that's one of the most unfortunate parts about comedy. That's why there's so many terrible shows and producers and people get taken advantage of because of that. A lot of comics don't look at this from the perspective of, hey, this is a business. They look at it at, oh, it's an art, and it is an art, but they're like, I just want to go perform, and, oh, you want me to pay you? Okay, here's my wallet. Yeah. Take my credit card. You know, and it's like, no, don't do that, because it devalues it for everybody.
Funny thing, Dan, what is the one word that always gets associated with artist? Starving.
Yes, yep.
Starving artist. Show business. There's 4 letters in show, 8 letters in business. It's twice as important. And people don't realize that starting out. I'm all for art and creativity, and I encourage that in my students and my group, just because, like a big brother, I know how much fun that is. But without no business, there ain't no show.
Yeah,
and you got to learn that early. You got to learn it early. And how many people, you know, have you said, well, how did she make it? How did he make it? Well, they had a business sense, or they had someone around them that did.
That did, yep. Yep, they put in the work, and somebody there had that business sense. Yeah, because you have to have that. I learned that pretty, you know, I used to own another business before I did comedy, so I kind of had a business sense, so I've, you know, always kind of looked at that, and like, now don't get me wrong, as every comedian, I definitely did a show for terrible money that I shouldn't have, just so I could have it, but when you are early on, there are some gigs you have to take just to get that experience, you know, to grow. Because, you know, if you can't get out on the road all the time, you're not going to get, you know, if you can't get longer sets, it's hard to develop 3 to 5 minutes at a time.
No question about it.
You know, so you definitely have to take those gigs. But once you get to a certain level, one of the best lessons I think I've learned in my career is the ability to say no, and how powerful that is.
Most powerful word in the world.
Yep. You know, because I've had lots of gigs. People offer me certain gigs, and, you know, it's like, you want me to drive 6 hours for barely any money, you know, no lodging, barely gas money. And it's like, what? No thanks. I don't need that at all. I'm fine just staying home and not making this money that I would, you know, and not losing money.
What's funny to me now, let's see how the bookers, and I'm not going to name any names, but some bookers will offer, it's like a radio station contest. You know, the third emailer will get a gig in Aberdeen, you know, Wyoming or this obscure place, you know, Equatorial Guinea, $150, no room, no hood. It's like, who's going to take that gig, man?
Yeah, well, and unfortunately, somebody will, and that's where somebody it's just like, will. Oh.
And I don't know how they can survive and live with themselves, because a lot of them are making as much or more than at least the feature act, if not the headliner. Mm-hmm. And at the two-act show, and it's like, okay, you're putting out an email, and basically someone is answering. It used to be you'd have to call the booker, get him on the phone, get your calendar out, match it up. Now it's just that they're doing zero effort. I don't begrudge anybody making money, but there's got to be a flow for everybody to survive long-term rather than someone coming in and gouging.
Oh, absolutely.
Someone told me when I started out, they said, for every dollar you make in this business, someone else will be making 10 off of you. And I thought, that's not true. And yeah, I think it is true.
It's, yeah. Yeah, after a long career. And you also teach comedy as well. Is that something you do online, or you do that in person, or how are you doing that these days?
You know, I know I'm old. I realize that. I don't like the whole online thing. I think it could work for teaching and one-on-one, because I really think comedians on all levels need a mentor. You know, they just say, okay, this is the next 6 months. These are the gigs I'm going to do. This is the material I have. I'm thinking about recording a CD. What do you think? And I think someone from a business standpoint, but especially from a show standpoint, you know, where are you going to be working? Are you going to be doing clubs? Are you going to be doing corporate? Are you going to be doing colleges? What material? Cruise ships? It's a whole different thing. That's the one thing my 30 whatever years of experience can really help somebody. It's like, okay, let me look at your look. Let me look at what you're trying to do. What is your long-term goal here? Rather than, God, I got to pay my car payment this month. I'll just take my $200 at a nudist colony in Okoboji and just get out of there. And it's the wrong gig for them and wrong booking for you. And in a perfect world, which it never is, there should be a plan of attack. It used to be, you know, well, you're a comedian. You just work anywhere that hires comedians. Mm-hmm. No, a restaurant. Well, what we serve? Food. Well, who's it for? Anyone who likes to eat. How many comedians say, well, who's your act for? Anyone who likes to laugh. Well, I can tell right now you're going to be living in a worse car than you are this year, next year, because you've got to narrow your focus, yep. Man.
No, absolutely. And you're right, because a lot of comedians don't think about that either. There are so many other things that go into not just building your act and becoming a better performer, but you do have to think about your look. You have to think about long-term goals, short-term goals, you know, what you want to do. And a lot of comics don't think about that. They think that a lot of comics think short-term. And I've come to realize that where they think about, oh, this is what I got next. But then they don't think about, well, how can I use this to get to the next thing. They're just like, oh, yeah. I did this. This is great. And then they don't even think about what's next. And, you know, and you have to, like,
that's why I think you need a mentor. That's why I think you so much need a, that's got some more experience. Mm-hmm. Now you bring it. Here's one thing that's going to happen to you if it hasn't happened already, because it happens to everybody. When I first started, I was the young buck. I was in Milwaukee, and I was probably at least 5 years younger than all the other comics at the time. I was the young buck. And someone starts out in most every town like that. And I used to look out at the audience and says, oh, man, they're old. What am I going to talk to these people? And then one day, without warning, I looked out and said, oh, man, they're young. What am I going to talk to these people about? And there's no lead up to it. It's like one day, bam, you're old, and that's it. You make an outdated reference. And references change throughout generations. And even, you know, a few years ago, you know, who are the sex symbols? Or who are the hot sports teams? Or who are the reference points of just pop culture? You know, and I used to make fun of the older comedians. They would go up and they do an outdated pop culture. And then I did it one time, you know, years later. I'm thinking, what goes around comes around. You know?
Yep. No, absolutely. I've definitely felt that. Where I've looked at an audience, you know, and I'm like,
yeah, sure.
But I agree. And that's one thing, too. That's another thing that I've found funny. I mean, and granted, in comedy, there are a lot of predators out there when it comes to getting people's money. You know, both bookers, teaching, the whole nine yards. Like, there are a lot of scams out there, and I get where people want to be, you know, you got to be cautious. But at the same time, comedy is one of them industries where it always, I always find it kind of interesting how they're like, oh, you can just go do an open mic and learn comedy. Well, yeah, that's where you can learn to write and perform, but that doesn't teach you everything about comedy. So a lot of people crap on classes and learning, and I'm like, you can't be a doctor without education. You can't, you know, you can't go do most careers without some sort of education. why do people, you know, why are you crapping on comedy classes? Because it's kind of the same thing. And a lot of people that have taken the good classes seem to advance faster than people who just go do open mics. That's at least my observation.
It's a very good observation. When I started teaching classes, I had a car accident and I was almost dead. I broke my sternum, flipped a convertible over. I couldn't walk. And a local it was a local comedian DJ. It was an article in the paper, newspaper, which there aren't on newspapers anymore, but there was at one time. And it said, comedian near death is not going to walk anymore. So a local college club said, hey, are you going to be around for a while? We're interested in starting a night, secondary education of stand-up comedy. Would you like to teach a class? That was so foreign to me at the time. I said, you can't teach stand-up comedy. Either you're funny or you're not. And they said, well, we'd be willing to pay you a few bucks. And I said, Tuesday at 7 o'clock. We're having fun. And that's the reason I think, okay, it was going to be for people like me that were insanely wanted to be a comedian, nothing else. And it turned out it was exactly the opposite. It was people from all walks of life that wanted to dip their toe in the pool and to see what it was like.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out there and I said, look, everything I tell you, the best carpenter to learn from has got the least amount of fingers. He or she has sawed them off and had a horrible accident. So why do you have those stumps there? And to tell me, I'm going to tell you every mistake that I made, and we're going to put together 5 minutes. 5 minutes, that's a long time on stage. You know, get in the ring with Mike Tyson, even at his advanced age, for 5 minutes, you turn your head into guacamole.
Yeah.
One thing led to another, real quick. And it was a blast. It was a wonderful experience to watch them go up and do their 5 minutes. Some of them did 2 minutes. Some of them forgot their act. But it was so much fun that I really got addicted to the process of teaching. And in my very first class was a guy named Tom Clark. And if you haven't had him on your show, I think you should. He's a headliner now. He teaches his own classes. I could tell in the first 2 minutes of the first class that Tom Clark had a spark. There was something in him that he got it, and he was it. And I would say 99% of the students don't. I was thinking about it the other day. I probably had 3,000 people take my classes or one-day seminars through the years. And a lot of times it was a fun thing or a corporate thing. And those people weren't going to do it more than one time. And a lot of them didn't even make it through the class. But very, very rarely does someone actually have the spark to go do it full time. And that's just how it is. It's a very, very unique craft. And even if you're in music or acting, name me another profession where you're so alone the whole time. You're acting, you have other actors on stage with you. In the music, you usually have a band with you. Comedy, it's a lone wolf thing, man. You better enjoy your own company.
Yeah, you're absolutely right on that. And I don't know Tom personally, but he is a comic that I've heard of. Like, I know of him. I've seen seen his headshots around a lot, seen him headlining lots of clubs and stuff like that.
Yep.
So
Tom's a great person, and he just had the chops, man. He had the toolbox, and you could see that right away. But I think the point I was trying to make to bring that whole thing up is when I started teaching my classes against my will, there wasn't another comedy class within 1,000 miles
of
Milwaukee. And then I moved to Chicago and I started teaching for Zanies. I was Zanies' official teacher for 25 years. And I run the classes there at all their locations. I taught some in Nashville and stuff like that. So now I think the last count I had in Chicago alone, there were 8 classes.
Oh, wow.
8. In Chicago. And there's a couple in Milwaukee. And I'm thinking, okay, these people have no business near sound amplification equipment. You've never got a dollar to be a comedian. It's like a Catholic priest doing marriage counseling. What do you have to tell about marriage? You haven't done it. I've done it. I don't ever begrudge anybody from teaching in class, but all I ask is have gone through the pay your dues and have something to tell your students. Don't just take their money.
Yeah, absolutely.
It infuriates me.
Yeah. And I was going to say, anytime I see a class or workshop or anything around comedy, my first question is what are your credentials? What have you done? Because, like you said, if they haven't been doing comedy or, they've only been doing comedy for 1 to 2 years and they're not even featuring, what do they know about the business? You know what I mean? Like,
well, that's the thing. The first thing I told my very first class and every class since, the first thing in the first 3 minutes, number one, I cannot make you funny. I don't claim that. Anybody that does is stealing your money. Number two, I offer a 100% money back guarantee at any time. You think I'm an idiot, you don't believe what I'm saying, I'm not going to fight with you, I'm not going to argue with you, I'm going to cheerfully refund your money, and you're going to go down. This is coming from my heart and my soul. I'll be talking about comedy whether or not you're around. I'm not in this to take your money. I think I've earned your money for my experience level, but I want you to be the judge of that. And in thousands of students, I had two people that have asked for a refund.
Wow.
And they were both guys over 50, if not 60, and they ran their own business. And they were used to having everybody basically suck up to them and kowtow. And I said, no, that's not right. That's not, you know, the right reason. So they just could not give up control. I said, you know what? You went through the free class that I always offered, the one-day seminar, the whole level of beginner classes, and you asked for, both of them asked for their refund like a week before the graduation. So I'm thinking, okay, you went through 90% of the class. You weren't a superstar. I never promised you were going to be a superstar. So I'm thinking 2 out of 3,000 is pretty good.
No, absolutely. That is good. And just kind of to piggyback off talking about comedy classes and stuff, you know, being that you've taught for, you know, years, what are some things that you like that people, if they're thinking about taking a comedy class, you know, and obviously, you know, if you're in the area where Dobie teaches, go take his class. But outside of that, what are things they should be looking at with a class, you know, like to kind of determine, is this a good class or is somebody just taking my money?
A couple of things. Number one, talk to the person that teaches it. Talk to them one-on-one for a couple of minutes. I would suggest in person if you can, or, you know, rather than the phone, do you like this person? You know, if you're going to be trusting them with your hopes and your dreams, do you feel like they're just taking your money? Do you feel like that they have experience? And they don't have to be good comedian. I mean, you don't have to like their act per se, but they should have been through their wars. And I interview some other students. What do they think of it? I have people that hated me. I thought you were a maniac and you worked us to death. And in retrospect, 10 years later, you're the only one that told me the truth, man. Thanks. I really appreciate that. It's like a drill sergeant, man. I'm preparing you for combat, for war, for driving with your check engine light in Bemidji, Minnesota in December with bald tires, and the club is closed and the booker forgot to tell you and you don't have enough money to get home, and you think that's not comedy, but it is comedy.
Yep.
You want to be a comedian, that kind of stuff happens. That's what I'm preparing you for. I'm trying to give you an act that'll make bar people laugh, because that's where you're going to be coming up through the ranks before you get a career. You got to crawl before you walk, before you run. And it's so funny to see the blank looks of fear and horror when I tell these people these things in the classes. It's like, that's what you have to hear. And it's, well, I've got hours of material. No, let's get 5 funny minutes. 5. I want 5. Well, I'm good. And the flag go down a flaming ball of smoldering wreckage. It's like, you don't have 5 minutes. And that's not a bad thing. I didn't have 5 minutes. It's like, I'm walking you through.
Yeah.
I'm walking you through the... Did you ever see when Tony Robbins has the people walk through the flaming coals? You know, that whole thing. Well, that's what I'm doing with the students. I'm holding your hand the whole time, but we're walking through the flaming coals, man. It's an effort here.
Yeah. I think when I started comedy, if I would have... Because where I started comedy, the classes, that wasn't an option. They weren't... You know, mm-hmm. It was a small... They weren't... That wasn't a thing. But if I would have had somebody tell me everything you just said now, I probably would have quit and not even did it. Because everything I knew about comedy was what I saw on Comedy Central. You know what I mean? So, like, I was so naive about comedy. And then I started doing stand-up, and then I moved out to California, and my mind was just blown.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing to me. I lived in California for about a year in L.A., and I thought, boy, this is going to be the cream of the cream, and the best comedians in the world are going to be here. I saw some of the worst comedy I've ever seen in my life in L.A.
Yep.
And a lot of them are, you know, actor/comedian, which in show business speak is neither/nor. They're both different skills. You know, if you got a hyphen in your business card, you ain't nothing. And I tell people, it's like, there's no crime or sin or anything. You can choose what you want to do. And you might want to take some acting classes, and maybe you find out you're going to be an actor. But my point is, eventually you're going to have to focus on something. Well, Kevin Hart does stand up and he does movies. Well, there are a lot of, there's a few exceptions, but assume it's not you.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and I try to talk to people too. It's like, okay, are you in this to try to be a star, to get back at your father who didn't love you? Why are you in it? And there's no right or wrong answer, but I want you to know so we can move ahead accordingly. Because it's never going to be fair. You know how it is. You're going to go up there and you're going to give them your best 5 minutes, and there's 20 other comics on stage and nobody sees you. And it's like, it's just so disappointing and disheartening. So I want to make the highs not so high and the low is not so low, so it's more of an even ride, or you put a bullet in your head, man. This is a rough stuff.
You're not wrong.
No.
No, not at all. Because it is. There's the highs are high and lows are lows, and if you can find that middle ground, you're doing good. And that's a good kind of a lead into, because I like to talk about what we call on this show the bumming a bombing, which is a dreadful feeling you get from bombing or having a bad show. And how is that affected you, and really with, you know, someone has been doing comedy so long, how has that changed over the years? Like, how have you kind of dealt with that?
I kind of look at it as the stripper's feeling the first time she lets her boobs fly for sailors and drunks. You know, the first couple times it's got to be hideous and horrible, and then a callus comes over your heart and you think, you know what, they're not going to touch me, I'm going to get my rent money, I'm just going to think about something else and move on. And a lot of times I used to think, oh, I'm bearing my soul for these people and they don't like it. And then it got to the point where, you know what? I've done well before. I've done poorly before. I will do well again. This is a car payment. And if you don't like it, it's you. And there's a callus that forms on your soul. And I know that sounds hard, but if you don't get that callus and you can't get too low after the bad ones or too high after the good ones, you won't last a long time. Then there's the King brothers, smoking, drinking, whatever. That gets in there too. So it's a whole process that's not just telling jokes. And if I'd have known that before I started, I probably wouldn't have done it. I would have been the best heckler because I would have been this angry, bitter asshole that's just, you're not funny. I really do think that hecklers are frustrated comedians.
Oh,
they want to be up there, but they don't have the guts to do it.
That's a really good observation.
It's totally true.
That's pretty spot on. It really is.
And that's one thing, too, when you get that callus. I mean, I used to bring up haymakers from the floor. I've had the cops call on me so many times. People have rushed the stage. I know exactly. My father was a biker, and I call it being a dented can. Comedians are comedians because we're dented cans. We didn't get enough love as a kid. So all the hecklers, they used to call me the razor. Oh, Dobie's the razor. He'll slice someone to shreds. And it wasn't the heckler I was getting even with. It was my father. I didn't realize that until years later. And some 300-pound jerk would start yelling and screaming, and I would just know. My father taught me one thing. Go right for the malady. Are they bald? Are they overweight? Do they have a witchy way eye? Go right for that, because it's been picked. That scab has been picked their whole life. And you come up with a line right in front of everybody, and it just lays them out, and it just sends them into circuit fry. And people have, you know, and I learned over the years that that's how to defend yourself. So I was confident. I was like Bruce Lee going into a bar fight. You know what? I'll reach down your throat, rip out your heart, and show it to you before you die, and then go pick my teeth and take a leak and leave. You know what I'm saying? I didn't go out my way to look to do that, but I could defend myself with anybody.
Yeah.
And so it's so funny because the comedians would watch in the back, and then someone was, and I go up, and it's, oh, he's going to rip one. And so someone would fire up a little BB at me, and I would fire 6 bazookas, 4 howitzers, and a nuclear bomb back to them. So finally, it's like, all right, you're poking at me. It's like, don't poke the tiger. Bam, I'll lay you out. And none of that has anything to do with comedy. It's all the problems. So who's going to go on TV and pick with hecklers? You're not. So rather than building a career, I was building I had a job for 35 years. I never had a career because I was too busy trying to make a living.
Yep. No, that makes sense. And speaking of that, you know, you call comedians the dented can. You also, this is a good time to plug this. You have a podcast called The Dented Can, correct?
The Dented Cast.
Oh, Dented Cast. Okay.
But it's for dented cans. And I just ad-libbed it on stage one night. I said, man, I am a dented can. What am I doing in this place? Blah, blah, blah. And someone came up, this guy, it came up and said, you know, I'm a dented can too. And he said it by name back to me. He didn't know my name, but he remembered that term. And then I said it on the radio a few times. It just kind of, oh, yeah, I can relate to that whole thing. Because a lot of us, I mean, I don't want to get nosy about your personal background, but I highly doubt most comedians I know haven't come from the typical, what would you call it, the Judeo-Christian nuclear family where everything was okay. You know, we're messed up. We're screwed up. We're abandoned, whatever it is.
There's always something.
There's always something, the dent in your can. And I think it is that society treats us as dented cans poorly. I used to work in a grocery store. They stuck the dented cans in a cart in the back of the store. And same with comedians. You'll do anything. You'll drive 6 hours like we were talking about before, 6 hours for low money, because if you don't do it, someone else will. And the bookers get that mentality that they abuse us. And we take it, and that's how it is, because we want that stage time. It's dysfunctional all the way around. So I'm trying to change that, you know, one guy at a time. Just try to be nice. And, you know, I ran a club for a while, and I would call the comics back. I said, you know, I don't have any room for you right now, but I really appreciate it. Oh, my God, I can't believe you called me back in person. Yeah, because I'm a comic, too, and I know what that's like. Self-esteem, dignity, human kindness. I know that's corny and sappy, man. I'm not trying to be Tony Robbins, but to me, it goes a long way, and that's all I care about. What you want to be, quote-unquote, big star and rich and famous and still be an ass? I don't want that. I'd rather be an unknown. Who's that guy? I never heard of that guy. And be able to sleep at night knowing that I'm a good guy. I help somebody.
Absolutely. No, and I think that's a good, that's your legacy right there. It's not your Facebook yep. group. It's you being kind and helpful and just being a nice person. And that's, I think that's huge.
Well, I appreciate that. Well, what has happened over the years, and thank you for that nice comment. I run into comics I haven't worked with in 20 years. And they'll go off with this big story and says, man, I had nobody. You shared your hotel with me and you didn't have to buy me dinner and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, I don't even remember doing it. And they remember it 20 years later. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And that is just a cool thing. There's a comic named Tim Cavanaugh. I want to give him a plug. If you've never heard of Tim Cavanaugh, he's on Bob and Tom all the time. He's a wonderful comedian and a fantastic guy. And one of the first times there's a show called The Dr. Demento Show, which plays funny songs. I don't know if it's around anymore, but he was on for years and years. And I had heard Tim for years playing his songs. He's a musical act. And I remember when I first started, I was so not ready to open for him. I got a job working with him at a pizza place in Waukegan, Illinois called Freddy's Pizza. And I did horrible because I was new. But here's Tim Cavanaugh, who I thought was a celebrity, and they hated him too. And I thought he was hilarious. But he was, and afterwards he said, hey, man, I'll buy you a pizza. We'll hang out. And at the end, I said, hey, you know, he bought. He said, and I said, well, thanks for doing it. He goes, no, this is not me buying you a pizza. This is comedy buying you dinner. And I want you, when you come up the ranks to be headliner, I want you to buy other comedians coming up the ranks a meal and pass it forward, pay it forward. That's what I want you to do. So I tell him every time I see him, and I tell comedians that I must have, that one pizza bought thousands of meals over the country over decades, because I said, Tim Cavanaugh did this to me. I'm doing it to you. And people said, I got to close my first show. And their biggest thrill was I got to buy the opener dinner. that makes me like a proud dad.
That's
what I'm saying. And there's a, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's beautiful.
No, and there's a camaraderie here. And the one thing I think that's missing, and you'll ask any comedian from my era that came out, is it used to be, if you had a scene in a town and there's more than one club, you do your sets and then you'd gather at some all night diner. And there was, sometimes there's two or three comedians, sometimes there's 10 or 12 comedians. And you'd sit up a lot of times till the sun came up. How did your set go? What bits are you working on? Hey, here's a tagline you might be able to use. Who are the new bookers coming up with gigs? And it was like a live internet before the internet. And we hung out, and some of the greatest times we had was sitting with those comedians. And you ask any old comedian, oh, God, I miss hanging in the diner with the comics. And now I think that's missing, because you learn things, you know, bit by bit. And yeah, Zoom meeting, you know, with comics, it's not the same. And I'm not trying to be this, you know, you damn kids, get off my head. I'm telling you, the camaraderie with comedians, and I talk to wrestlers about that too. They would learn about wrestling driving across the country, a 400-mile trip. Hey, kid, here's what you need to be doing. And I did that with comics. I learned talking to headliners when I started. And then as I became a headliner, I would take comics on the road and say, you might want to do this. And that process, it's like the Native Americans passing down the tribal traditions. There's an honor, there's a dignity, there's a culture there. And I really think that the comedy is just such a rare fraternity that it should be revered and respected. So when you're doing a show like this, I really appreciate it, because you're perpetuating, you're paying it forward too.
Trying. That's always
you're
the goal.
Succeeding. That's so funny to me. You've been doing it 12 years. I mean, when I was doing it 12 years, I thought, God, I'm so good. I'm so experienced. No offense. I look at you as, he's a nice guy, but he's a pup.
Yeah.
I've been 35.
It's funny because even though I've been doing comedy almost 12 years, I know that I'm like, people, they're like, oh, how long you been doing comedy? I've been, well, a while, but compared to some people, I'm still new.
Yeah. But you know what, and it's great. Man. Yeah. I'm really glad to see it. You get the right attitude.
Yeah, yeah. And that's one thing, too. I think that another really good lesson that I had or that I learned was that you can never, you in order to get better, you have to keep learning. This is a continuous learning thing. You can't just, oh, I'm good. No, that's not how this works. You can always be better. There's and every show that we do, whether it's good or bad, every interaction with people that we have in the industry and everything that happens, you know, adjacent to comedy, it's another lesson to help get us better, you know, better at our as comedians and performers, and hope, you know, better people. That's kind of how I look at it. So that's always been kind of my goal.
Totally. And you're never going to get better at anything if you don't work with people that are better than you. And I had a friend of mine in radio who started out in Canada, a small town. He said a lot of kids would play in their small town or their region, and they would play hockey, and they were the best in the region. Then they go to the next level, and there was other kids that were just as good as them, and it would be a head game. It would psych them out, and they would often quit because they think, well, I'm not the star anymore. And I think same with comedy. You know, there was kind of a time when I was the pup in Milwaukee. Then I moved up the ranks, and I was the best guy. And I'm thinking, well, I could stay here and go nowhere or move to Chicago 90 miles away where there's 15 guys that are better than me. And there's always somebody better than you. And if you hang with those people, you will get better by osmosis. And that's exactly the right thing to do. Hard to admit you're not the best. It's hard to think, you know what, I got a ways to go. But realize that and know it's always going to be there, no matter what level you are. That's why it's a craft.
Not absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, I've seen that where the hanging with comics that are, you know, being around comics that are better is going to make you better. I've seen that firsthand just in different scenes. You know, some of the people that I know kind of palled around together, they, you know, and they were good, and they got, you know, the ones that weren't good got better just by being around, you know, because you do, you're constantly learning, and you can learn by watching other comics. That's another thing that kind of blew my mind. When I moved back to the Midwest, we had a comedy club, and we had a little local scene in Sioux Falls. It wasn't huge. It's still not huge. They're still got a, but they got a good little scene in South Dakota now. But a lot of comics weren't if they weren't working, and most of them weren't working yet, they weren't going to shows, you know, to watch these touring comics that were coming through. And I would always say, I don't, you know, if you have a comedy club, and if, you know, most comedy clubs, not all, but most, if you're a comic, they'll, you know, and there's room, they'll let you come watch a show for free, unless it's a special sure. event or whatever. And you can learn so much from watching other comics and, you know, networking. Because after the show, you can talk to the comic and say, oh, yeah, I'm a local comic, new comic, whatever. It might not lead to anything, but it's still a good start at networking. And it just always blew my mind because so many comics don't do that.
You know, it does blow my mind. And most comedians will at least talk to you. You know what I'm saying? If they're out of town, a lot of times they're lonely, they're bored. And what I've found is that the higher you go on the level of big comics, they'll be the nicest to you when they don't have to be, because they know how hard it is. And if you're sincere, they'll spend a few minutes with you. If you ask them decent questions, hey, what do you recommend? What should I do to get started? They'll help you. They'll talk to you and keep that contact, as you say. And so many comedians don't do that. There's a guy I want to bring up. Do you know John Roy? Does that name ring a bell? John Roy started in Chicago. He's in L.A. now. He's done several. I think he did Craig Ferguson, a couple of those kind of shows, more than I did. And he's younger in the business than me. He's about 10 years younger than me. And for whatever reason, we worked at Zanies together. And there was about four or five bookings in a row. I was a regular for Zanies, where I was the closer, and he would happen to be the feature act. And he watched me every single night, my entire set, even on Friday, second show, when he could have gone. You see what I'm saying? And Saturday, we had a way to get paid, but Friday, he could have gone. And I said, what are you still doing here? He goes, oh, I'm just watching, paying my dues. And John Roy, to this day, is the one guy that has the show and the business at the most equal I've ever seen anybody. He's very good at his bookings and his offstage business, and he works on his act diligently. I have a whole lot of respect for that guy just because he gets it and he grasps it. And I always told him, I said, anytime you got a TV show, I was the first one to call him and congratulate him. Says, yeah, that's for watching my BS, you know, late show Friday, that you were willing to do that. And it was probably, you know, it was a suburban club, so probably a 30, 40-mile drive. And he lived in the city at the time. So, yes, if you happen to have a place where if you're watching this in your comic and you're in a scene like the Twin Cities or wherever you are that's got a scene, stay and watch the comics. Well, I'm going to go out to party with my friends. You can, but if you're investing one more hour to watch the comic and just say, hey, I really like that bit you did about blank. You know what I'm saying? Nothing, you know, you're going to stroke the ego of a comic. They'll sit and talk to you.
Yep, absolutely.
They will. Oh, that bit you did about your marriage. Oh, I love that. Oh, really? Do you like it? What? And that's how to get a contract. And you don't have to be sucking up or kissing ass or anything like that. It is networking, and that is the right term for it. Some people are like, oh, I want to, you know, do it my own way. Well, you know what? You're going to be drifting a long time, man. It's a social business. They got to like it. Sometimes there's a term I call you're good in the car. You know, mm-hmm. Is he funny? Or she funny? They're funny enough, but I got a 6-hour drive and I don't want to strangle this person 10 minutes outside of our hometown. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And there's a lot to be said about that too. And if your act is a little bit weaker, you'll still get the gig because you're likable.
Yep.
You're
no, absolutely.
Demands. You know, you're doing your time on stage. You don't, if you're hired to do 30 minutes, you don't do 42 when the crowd is great and 16 when the crowd is not great. You do 30 minutes every night. And that takes years to learn that whole process.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not trying to say, you know, I'm just trying to offer as many tips as I can only because I want to see comedy perpetuate. You know what I'm saying? I'm on the slide. You know, I never thought I'd get to that point. You know, but it's to the point where when I die, I don't want a robot entertaining. There's nothing about a live show when you're up there and you experience it in your 12 years. There's nothing like that feeling of kicking ass in front of a live audience, man. It's that's the drug. That's the heroin.
Yep, it is.
It's just driving on those 19-hour hell gigs.
Yep. that's what you hope for because that's what makes that drive worth the drive.
And on the other hand, when you think you got it figured out and you get to another level where you just start featuring or you just start closing shows or it's going really well and you take it for granted and boy, I am hot stuff now. Then you have that one that knocks you on your ass. That's a, ooh, boy. And that happens to everybody on every level. You know, and it's like, so it keeps you humble, but also keeps you going and you never arrive. It's all about the journey. I'm not trying to sound like Yoda, but it's really true. It's about the journey. Have fun, have good people. Now you and I are contacts, like it or not.
No, you know, I
do too. I love what you're doing. So I'll promote what you're doing. Hey, check out what Dan's doing and blah, blah, blah. And that's how it should be. You build a network of good people. And you know what? God forbid that I would ever hit anything, but you know, hey, I need a nice guy. Oh boy, Dan Pudlitz, he'd be great for that part.
Mm-hmm.
You know I'm saying be around those kind of people because it's not, they, if they hit it, they need people.
No, absolutely. And that's another thing that, you know, going back to being nice and networking, a lot of comics don't think about when you look at people who when they get a TV show or they do something, a lot of times the other people that end up getting involved in the project are their friends.
Yes.
They're not just hiring strangers. Some of it is, yes, but a lot of times it's their friends. A good example of that is that, I don't know if you saw this show, but there's a TV show called Those Who Can't, and it was the Grawlicks. They're a comedy troupe out of Denver, three comics. They got this TV series, ended up being on True TV, and a lot of the other guest stars and writers and things like that were their friends and other comics, a lot of comics from Denver, even some filmmakers from Denver got to be involved in this show. And it goes back to what you're saying. It was like they needed people, and they brought the people that they liked, their friends, and the people in their circle. So just kind of...
It's a two-way street, too, because those people, they know what they can do. They know they're going to show up. There's a lot to be said. Drew Carey did that too. Mm-hmm. He brought a lot of people from Cleveland, people that he knew into his sitcom when he had it. And it's human nature. You know, people will know what they like. They like what they know. Well, is he a good writer? He's funny enough. He's good in the car. He's funny in the room.
Good in the car.
That's it, man. Be good in the car first and get your foot in the door. Then if you screw it up afterwards, I mean, I've screwed myself out of so many opportunities because people didn't know me and they heard about me. Oh, that guy's a jerk. Then they would meet me and say, God, you're one of the nicest guys I ever met in my life. Yeah. Well, I, you know, blew my fingers off there. So it makes it that much harder. It's already hard, but it's that much harder if you have a reputation of being hard to work with before someone even meets you. Let them meet you. Then they can decide.
Yep. Absolutely.
That alone's worth watching. If you're a new guy,
that's the big tip for this show. I got a few more things I want to talk about and then we'll get kind of wrapped up. When you're on stage and you tell a joke and it bombs, in the moment, what goes through your mind?
Well, there's a certain part of my body that slams shut, and it's in the backside of my pants. everybody hates that. You know, you throw it out there, and it's like, you know, you go to kiss the girl and she doesn't kiss back, and you say the joke and it's gotten laughed. Maybe it hasn't gotten laughed. Maybe it's the first time you said it. And there's that deafening silence. And you know it's only 2 or 3 seconds, but it seems like about 4 years. And just everything shuts down and your self-esteem is gone. It's the worst experience in the world to bomb, to have it not hit. So I was always one to do savers. you know, a saber line. Oh, that yep. was funny when I wrote it. Hey, what you, is this thing on? You know, whatever it is. And, you know, Johnny Carson was really good at that. A lot of young comedians don't even know who Johnny Carson was, but he was an excellent ad lib bomber, you know, and sometimes got to the point where they would write lines, you know, as savers. And I think I just want people to have a good time. So I came up with that style on my own, but sometimes you got to just let the joke die on its own. And it's bad when, as a comic, you love that joke. You wrote that joke. It was funny. Maybe you had some other comics, you ad-libbed it and all the comics laughed, and you take it on stage and you just can't get it to work. You try. How many times do you try? How many times do you try a line before you give up on it?
Oh, me? A lot. I really like try hard. I should probably not try as hard as I do on some things, but I'm just like, I'm going to make it work. I'm very persistent. Yeah.
It's like drowning your babies. I wrote this. I don't got to laugh. Damn it.
Yeah. And it's like, and with that, as a writer, I know that you need to, you know, sometimes you need to kill your babies, but sometimes I'm just like, I can't do, I just got to keep going.
Yeah. And it's so funny, especially when you're having a good set and you're thinking, oh, this is going to kill now. And you bring it in there and it totally grinds it to a screeching halt. It's like, oh, what did I do that for?
Yep.
Why did I bring that in? But that's part of the fun of it, too, because on the flip side of that, it's like being in a casino. It sucks when you lose, when you hit on 17 at the blackjack table, you know, and you get a five. It's like, well, okay, it's 22. I still lost. But you almost won. But then when you hit the blackjack, same thing. When you do that line and it does kill, the thrill outweighs the pain, but you got to live with one without the other. So yeah, it sucks when a line bombs. It does, or a whole routine, or a premise, or worse yet, a whole set.
Yeah, and that definitely happens.
I've always been a natural. I can usually make. I'm not bragging. Some people have a natural. Some people mm-hmm. are very crafted. And there's no right or wrong. You get the cards you're dealt, and you work with that. But to me, I've seen guys go up there, and women too, and just eat it for an entire 45-minute set and barely one laugh. I'm thinking, you know what? I would just say, look, I give you guys your money back. Let's go out for ice cream or something. It's not working tonight. I don't know what the deal is, but it's supposed to be fun, right?
It absolutely, absolutely is. You got to have fun.
You question your existence when you have sets like that.
Yeah, you really do. I've definitely been there. And I think, though, you know, I had a guest. I had Ryan Niemiller on here last week, and he talked about that a little bit about, you know, you got to hate what you love. And he made a good point. He's like, if you're not having sets where that's questioning you doing comedy, you're not in it. You know, like,
yeah. but I'll say this now, that's where the art part is. And he's totally right. I don't disagree with one word that you said, but when you're out there and this is your living, this is what you have to do, and you're 500 miles from home, and it could be a one-nighter. It's not that many week-long comedy clubs anymore. It's like, yeah, you can have maybe one offset, but your livelihood depends on it, man.
Yep.
You got to get some laughs, and the club owners, well, they weren't nice. No, they're in business to sell hooch, you know, beer, whatever. Your job is to get the laughs. It's not art when you're getting paid for it. So that's what I think that the whole show versus business comes into effect. It's easy to sit in open mics. Well, I wouldn't put up with that. Well, if your car payments do, yeah, you would.
That's right. Yeah, if you're trying to pay those bills.
Pay those bills, man. And it's like you hate to be, it just gives you that callus, man. You got to get that callus at some point, or you can't do it full time.
Nope. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, I got a couple more things, and then we're gonna open it up for a Q&A. So the people that are watching, I know somebody, Josh had, he posted a comment earlier. That was from Nico. He was posting in the Facebook group, this comment here, but the one that said, hi, told me to tell you hi. That was, Scott Curtis. He's, you know, he's got his,
Scott Curtis.
His name's not showing up, but Scott Curtis is who said that. So
another good podcast. I love to see guys that love the business. Scott does. You do.
Yep. Josh Scott's does. Scott's great.
Yeah. Absolutely. He's a member of my group too.
Yep.
Both you guys are royalty and you have carte blanche.
All right. I like it. Yeah. All right. So again, we're going to be doing questions here in a little bit. So if you're watching, I know there's not a ton of people watching right now, which is fine. But if you're watching and you have some questions about comedy, this is going to be the time. Start getting those questions in there. We're going to do a couple things and then we'll bring Josh back in and do this Q&A. I like to go more positive towards the end of the podcast, and I got a couple things.
Good, man.
I love
let's get out of that rut.
One thing, we've been building the Art of Bombing Get Pumped playlist, which it doesn't have to be a song that gets you pumped for comedy, just something, you know, that gets you pumped for whatever you're into. Do you have a song that gets you pumped and just ready to go?
Believe it or not, my favorite band of all time is George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic. I've loved them since I was in school. I love them now. There's a song called Flashlight, which came out in 1977. And if that doesn't shake your rump, you are not human, because this is the funkiest tune in history, I think. And that I like to play that a lot of times. I play Parliament when on the way to a gig. Puts me in a good vibe, good space.
Excellent. I like it.
What's yours?
Yeah. Oh, man, I have lots of songs that get me pumped. I don't have necessarily a particular song, but ska. Any kind of ska music gets me going.
And, that's cool.
I'm a big,
but that's real big rhythm,
Fish guy.
That's real rhythm.
Yep.
Yeah, Fish is cool. Jam bands.
Yep. So, you know, one of their songs that really gets me going is Beer. but pretty much any kind of jam band ska music will get me pumped.
Well, I think you'd like the Parliament Funkadelic. The
people. Oh, I'm sure.
I also like Psycho Killer by Grateful Dead. That's a good one before a show, too.
Nice.
A real live wire. Yeah, that's exactly. Well, it depends on what mood you're in, too.
Yeah.
I think too, that you don't necessarily have to be pumped up, but you have to be focused before you go on stage.
No, absolutely. And that's why, before shows, I don't really listen to music before shows. I'm more thinking about my set. Some people can listen to music to get them, you know, pumped up to go do their show. And I think that's great. I personally, I got to be thinking about my jokes.
I totally get that too.
Gotta be.
Everybody's different too. And there's no one. That's another thing I try to tell students. Like, you got to find what works for you.
Yep.
I'll give you 6 options. Test a few of them out and see what works.
Yep, absolutely. And then like I said, because I like to go more positive, we talk about bad shows. I always love to hear a story about a time where you had one of your favorite gigs. And, you know, and it doesn't have to be a big gig. It doesn't have to be, it can be just a gig that you really loved.
Well, there's a singing husband and wife duo called Ashford and Simpson. Don't know if you know who they are. They've written a lot of R&B songs in the 70s and 80s. Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson. And for whatever reason, I grew up in Milwaukee. My neighborhood was very multicultural, multiracial. We had a Muslim contingency. We had African-Americans. We had Spanish. We had Asian. And just where I grew up, it's just a mix of that. And I always really liked Black audiences. I just did. And they look at me, a dorky white guy who knows who George Clinton is. What is this? It's just like my rhythm happened to be in that. And there's a place in Milwaukee, I'm sure every city's got one. It's called the Riverside Theater. It's about a 2,500 seater. And I was doing business in comedy maybe 2 years at the time. And I was totally not ready for it. They needed a cheap opening act to do 20 minutes in front of Ashford and Simpson, 2,500 people. And it's so funny, the promoter's like, well, what's that white boy going to go out in front of that black audience for that? And I went out there and absolutely ripped them a new one. It's like one of those, I had to stop and let the laughs go to the back of the room and come back, because I was in their wheelhouse, man. And that was the first time I really thought that, man, this is the drug that I heard that comedy was. And I'm not gonna get racial or anything, it just happened to be, they didn't expect a white boy to be on their wavelength. They were a wonderful audience, and that stands alone. That kind of popped the cherry, man. That got me going.
Wow, that's
awesome.
I wish
I could have toured with them. It was that good.
That's one of the things I think would be cool, is to tour with a band. I know some comics that have done it say it's not always great because the audiences don't do, you know, they're not there for the comedy or whatever, but I still think it would be cool. That's one of my goals. I actually have a friend of mine, a great comic, Neil Rubenstein. He's opening this year for, I'm going to have a brain fart. He's opening for a band, a very big band, which is really cool. And I'm like, oh, man, that'd be so fun to do that. But sometime, goals.
In theory, like communism, Could be good. Sounds good in theory, but you'll see how it works in real life. Depends on the band. You're part of that family, and all the band squabbles become your squabbles. I do recommend if you're and Tom Dreesen, you mentioned him before.
Yep.
Tom wrote a book. He He opened up for Frank Sinatra. And at the time in the 20th century, if you're young, you don't know who Frank Sinatra is, but he was the biggest star in the world at that particular time. Mm-hmm. And Tom was up there in front of 20,000 people, and he's got a book called Still Standing. I'll plug his book because he's such a great guy. And he talks about how that is, too, and the different moods of Frank. And, you're going in front of 20,000 people, and one night Frank will say, do 20 minutes, Tom. Next minute, do 35 minutes. And you got to be, to be able to be that versatile. And it's like that. So that's like the ultimate experience of opening for a music act. Because I don't think comedy necessarily works in front of, 2,500 is one thing, but 10,000, that's hard.
Yeah, yep.
I know the Dane Cooks have done it, and the Kevin Harts have done big. I don't begrudge them. It's Sebastian Maniscalco's of the world. But as far as the intimacy of comedy, it's hard to be that in that big of a venue.
No, absolutely. And I'm sure, just from comics that I've talked to that have done bigger shows, it's also, you got that weird, because the timing gets thrown off. You got to wait for, you tell a joke, and you got to wait for the laughs to get to the back of the room and then get back to you. And just kind of like virtual comedy, where you have that delay.
That's the worst, man. I don't know about you. I know that I'm old school, but to sit there in your underwear and try to make 16 people laugh on Zoom, it's like, nah, not for me.
Yeah, that's been, I've done a few and they've been fine, but that's been the biggest, is trying to remember that delay, because, you tell a joke and you feel like it bombed, and you're like, well, got to get to the next joke, and then all of a sudden everybody starts laughing, and you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. Delays.
It's a dance. It really is a dance. People think you're up there by yourself, but it's a dialogue, and your part is the material, and their part of the dialogue is the laughter. And once you know that, and you realize that it's not just about you, it's about all of you. And again, this is sounding like Zen Buddhist monk stuff, but that you got to know that it takes years to grasp that concept, man. You don't go from kindergarten to calculus in a year. It takes a lifetime. It does.
Yeah, absolutely. That's well said. All right, well, we're going to bring Josh back in, and then we're going to open up the Q&A. There's a few people watching, so we'll see if they want to ask some questions before we wrap things up. Again, if you're watching, thank you guys so much for watching, and thank you again, Dobie, for doing this.
Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate
it. This has been great.
This is my first credit of the new year.
Nice. It's a good credit. It's a good credit to have.
It is.
Oh, yeah, man. And Dobie, thank you so much, man. I've been listening this whole time, just hanging on every word.
I tell all my classes, I'll tell you guys, whatever I tell you about comedy, do exactly the opposite, and you'll be very successful.
All right. I love it.
Yeah, that's good instruction. It's very specific. And guys, we got a couple of questions coming.
Oh, really?
We
do. Real quick, before we get to that, I just want to give a shout out to Nico Lukoff, who was in. He was watching in the Facebook group. He made a couple comments, and I didn't mention his name,
Nico.
But I wanted to say that.
Appreciate you, bud.
It's all right. Go ahead with the question. Sorry.
Yeah, go right ahead. Sure.
Absolutely. Earlier in the show, Dobie, you mentioned, kind of how comedy is just its own unique form and how you have to bomb for a while as part of the experience to kind of, earn your stripes. How long do you have to do that is the question. How long do you have to bomb?
I'm going to give you a Yoda answer here. Until you're ready. When do you have kids? You have kids?
I don't, no.
Josh, you got kids? Okay. Yeah. How old is your son or daughter?
Son's 9.
9. Okay. When did your son walk?
13 months or so.
13 months. If he wouldn't have walked by 14 months, would you have broken his legs and put him in a wheelchair for the rest of his life? He walks when he walks. You bomb until you're... I'm not trying to be evasive in the question at all whatsoever, but some people just take to it a little bit better than others, and some people could be up to 30 years. I mean, if you've been around any scene, any city of the scene... There are those open micers that have been coming out 10, 15, 20 years, and they're horrible. And I used to, you don't want to take their dream away, but it ain't happening, man. I'm never going to play in the NFL, and it's like, I love it. I'm never going to play there. I have to know that. I had a tryout with the Kansas City Royals as a baseball player before I got into comedy. I got a second look, but I didn't make it. I stopped going to the tryout camps. And the same thing, if you're bombing that much, maybe writing is for you. Maybe producing shows is for you. Maybe stand-up is just not your thing. And That's not a bad thing to realize that. Yes, you have to bomb for a while, but if it happens, I mean, some people just have a natural flair and other people don't. Doesn't mean you're a bad person. You know, a lot of times what you want the most, I have people come into my class, they have a stack of Richard Pryor videos and they read every book. I can tell them 2 minutes on stage, it ain't in you, kid. You don't have it. And that's not an insult to you as a person. Maybe you'll cure cancer, but you ain't going to be a comedian.
Right.
And that's a hard thing to do. And I don't think it's on me to squelch people's dreams, but I don't want to mislead people either.
Yeah.
So you can have fun with it, but there comes a point when you're clogging the toilet for people that really need the stage time that have a chance to do something. And that's a very difficult position to be in. But does that make sense to you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It for a lot of people, it sounds like it's just unique to you. You can be a great comedian. It can take you a really long time to get there. But you could also be in a spot where this just isn't your medium. You're a funny person, you're a talented, a gifted person, but maybe you just have to do something else and express it in some other way.
Let me give a real quick example is that I did morning radio for a while. And I it's so funny because it was Lansing, Michigan was my very first job. And I was a guest at the comedy club there. And I'm pretty witty on the radio. It's something I could always do and cracked up a couple of liners. And the owner came in and said, "Hey man, you're really funny. How would you like to sit in for my morning show for a couple of weeks because he's on vacation?" So, all right, yeah. It turns out he was in rehab and they needed a morning show. I was in the right place at the right time. I was funny enough. So I got into morning radio and I've been in both sides of it. So I played in the majors. I was at the Loop in Chicago eventually and played the majors. And radio people think they can be funny on stage and a lot of comedians think they can be funny on the radio. Those are two different things. Acting and comedy, improv and comedy and radio are four different things. Know what you're good at. Maybe it might take you two or three or four things to go through and you could be naturally a funny person. What is your outlet for it? Might not be stand-up.
Yeah, exactly.
And it doesn't mean you're not funny. It's just its own thing, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of things just have to converge for you.
Yeah.
You know, writing, performing, the business side of it, all those things you have to be good at. Another question came in about the sort of show business. I'll kind of paraphrase this question to shorten it up. But essentially, are there two or three things for the show business for comedians that can be quick wins?
Say again.
So are there two or three things for that you would advise a comedian to do that would help their business side of the show business equation?
Yes, here's the first thing I would recommend to anybody, and it's hard to hear. Stay away from people with power when you suck until you're ready. The big mistake people make is, well, you know what? I got a good car, and I'm going to go to every comedy club within 1,200 miles of where I am, and I'm basically an open micer, and I'm going to showcase myself in front of all these people. I'm going to call and get auditions and call in favors, and you go in front of that person, and you stink. And they've seen 1,000 people and you're going to go right to the bottom of the list. And that's very expensive mistake because they will always see you at, it's like parents. A lot of times they'll see their kids. They could be 50 years old, but they see them as they're 5. You know what I'm saying? So the biggest thing in the business part is don't go in front of people that can help you until you're ready. That's number one.
Right.
Number two, be available, but not a pest. You know, call up, book me, book me, book me, book me, book me, book me, book me. That's the best way to knock it. You might want to call a booking agent and say, hey, you know what? I live in a town and there's a place here that might want to do comedy. I'm not a booker. I thought you might want to be turned over to you. Maybe I can have something that you can help this person with. It'll change their whole attitude. They'll take your call. If you're making the money, they'll take your call. Then give you a chance to build yourself a reputation. Maybe open at some of those shows, get to know the comedians and work your way up. That's the kind of stuff I think that it takes so long to learn. It's not about you. When I started out, there were actually the supply and demand. They needed comedians. There was about a tenth of the comedians that there are today, and it was 10 times more work. Now there's 100 times more, and there's a tenth of the work. So it's a numbers game. You know. So the business part, very, very important. Be accessible. I know business cards aren't really cool anymore, but have something to say, how can I get a hold of you? Don't just write something on a snot rag somewhere, here, call me, that kind of thing. Have something professional, something printed up to say, get a hold of me this kind of way. But again, don't have to force it on people. But you know, if I can do anything for you, not book me, book me, book me, because everybody's wanting that.
Yeah.
Exactly the opposite of that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I hope that helps a little.
Which I just kind of want to piggyback off that, where you're talking about book me, book me, book me. Do you have any tips for people to reach out to, like, as far as like etiquette when reaching out to bookers? You know, especially if they haven't already worked with that person. Like, this is the first time you're reaching out to somebody.
And I know people are going to mock me and ridicule me for saying this, and I've been mocked my whole life, but I totally agree with it. Don't show a video at all costs. If you want to do a live audition, it's one thing. But a video, usually a person that's watching it is not in the same room with you. You can't defend yourself. By the time they watch your video, you're going to be much better than you are from sending that video. So it's a false representation of who you are at the time. I've always been one for belly-to-belly business with somebody. Shake hands. I just drove 500 miles at my own expense. I'm putting myself up. I want to do a set for you. And I've had people not watch the set. There's a risk taken too.
Yeah, there is.
I think that's the best way to do business. And if you're ready and you go in there. Second thing, especially now in this day and age, find somebody that's in with that booker. Okay? And that's just the way it is. I say, okay, I'd like to get into Zany's in Chicago, for example. Okay, well, at the time when I worked in Chicago, Zany's is the place to work. And they book guys a lot. I was one of their guys. I would work, 12 weeks a year at each club, and they had four clubs. So I could spend my whole year in Chicago if I wanted to. Now, I could call the owner of Zany's, who used Seinfeld and Leno and knew everybody in the business. I could call the booker, the general manager, at 3:00 in the morning and say, I want to piss on your front window, blah, 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 blah. I could do that, and they might be angry, but I wouldn't lose my status with them. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
If you guys did that, or if I called, I don't know who's got power right now, someone at 3:00, who's this? You're done.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You have one strike and you're out. Have someone that's got a relationship that's tight with a venue and say, look, I would really like to get into this place. What would it take? I'll open for you. I'll drive for you. And not always be the right time, but at some time, I'd really like to get in this place. If you could help me with that, I would really appreciate that. The word of somebody that they know, like, and trust goes 1,000 times farther than you knocking on the doors and trying to do an audition and all that kind of stuff. And that's just how it is. It is who you know. Somebody that knows them, likes and knows you, and make that connection. It is worth, buy that person a steak dinner if you have to. Whatever it is, that's the best way to get through.
Oh, that's great.
It's not scientific, but it's true.
No, yeah, that makes sense to me. Well, I don't know. I don't see any more questions. Do you have any questions coming in on your end, Josh?
That was the two I got.
Okay, well, I think we're going to get wrapped up. Before we let you go, we like to play a game on the show called Pick a Number, where you pick a number between 1 and 20, and then we ask you a corresponding question that may or may not be related to comedy.
I'm going to go with lucky 13 because I've had horrible luck my entire life. I'm the only person I know that has run out of gas inside a car wash.
We're going full circle. And this is a great question. This is a great question. All right. Okay. What has been some funny advice someone has gave you? So what has been some funny advice someone has given you?
Funny advice. Okay. When I first started out, somebody told me to scream my jokes, because that'll make me set up. This is long before Sam Kinison ever did. And this guy, I don't know if he wanted me to, I never tried it or anything. I think he goes, yeah, you know what? You have high energy. If you just go up there and scream, it'll get your attention. And this guy was some drunk, but he came out to the comedy shows, the open mics every week. And that was what comedy was back then. So that was funny to me at the time. I never tried it, but I don't know if he was joking me or not, but that's what he said.
Scream your jokes.
Scream your jokes. That was it. Then Sam Kinison came along and I was out of business.
Oh, what a bummer. Yeah. Well, this has been great. Do you have any, you want to push people to anything in particular? Where can people find you online? All that jazz.
Oh, the Maxwell Method of Stand-Up Comedy is on YouTube. I'm writing another book. I have a book called Monkey in the Middle. My best friend since we were kids robbed a bank that he used to work at. True story. And he robbed it twice. He tried to blame one of them on me, and I had to wear a wire for the government to get him to confess that he did it. And there's some funny parts in it, and there's some not funny parts in it. And as it was happening, I thought, this is a movie. So before COVID, I was in L.A. trying to sell it into a movie. And you know, if a book gets made into a movie, they're always changing it. It'll be two Wayans brothers playing me and my buddy, and Caitlyn Jenner will be in it, and a duck. It'll be nothing like the real book. So that was a real hard thing. The next one's going to be of comedy road stories. I've got so many of them, just, brushing with famous people. I was heckled by Donald Trump. That's a true story.
Oh, wow.
Opening for Rosie O'Donnell in Florida. And he came out. They were friends at the time. This is in the mid-90s. And so he comes in, and they brought him in the darkness. And he, when are you going to get funny? That was his heckle.
Oh, man.
I said, look, I know who you are. Just pipe down here. We'll get through the show. Don't you just look stupid like you do at work all day long. I'm running the show. So 30 seconds later, I'm still waiting. So, okay. So they turn the lights on. So everybody, it's Donald Trump. It's Donald Trump. It's, oh, my God, it's Donald Trump. And now he puts his napkin up like, you know, white flag. He says, oh, no. When am I going to get it funny? When are you going to finish that stupid haircut you got there? So I lit into him like the heckler, you know. But, and finally, it's like, all right, the crowd's going crazy. I said, can we please bring up Rosie O'Donnell now? So Rosie O'Donnell did. And at the end of the night, the book bodyguard came up and said, Mr. Trump thought you were very funny. I said, well, he could have come over and told me that. So, and then they ended up not paying their bill. The bodyguards thought that Trump did it, and Trump said, so the next day, they made the paper, you know, Trump comes to comedy club, doesn't pay, so he sent a $100 bill over with the bodyguard. And I happened to be talking to Milwaukee, so they made the Milwaukee paper. You know, local comedian gets heckled by Donald Trump in Florida. But you know, when are you going to get funny? It's just little stories like that of 35 years on the road, so.
Oh, that'll be great. I look forward to that.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Whatever I can ever do to help you, assist you, I appreciate you. Please post it in my group. I will tell people about yours, whatever you need me to do to advertise, man. And thank you very much for having me. Happy New Year, too.
Happy New Year to you as well. Thank you so much. We're going to let you go. This has been great. Thanks again, Dobie. And
see you guys.
We'll see you around. Wow.
Wow.
That was an amazing episode. We could have kept going for another hour and a half and turned this into a Joe Rogan for getting better at comedy podcast. but we can't keep everybody's time. But yeah, that's this is an amazing episode.
Absolutely. It's not very often in one of these episodes that during the interview portion, I need to go get my computer charger and plug it in. But I did that because we were just going, man. And I, you know, it was obviously so much Dobie was able to provide us just talking about comedy as a craft, you know, and how you have to treat that as a lawyer treats law or a doctor treats medicine. That's a big takeaway for me tonight, man.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. No, he had so much great information and just a perspective on comedy too. You know, he's very realistic. He's got a very realistic perspective on it. And there's a lot of delusion in comedy. We need more realistic perspectives in comedy. We really do.
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty genuine, man.
Well, I think that's going to do it for today, everybody. We want to say thank you so much for tuning in to the podcast or to the live stream. You know what to do wherever you're watching. If you're on Twitch, if you're on YouTube, make sure you hit the follow, subscribe. If you're listening to this later on down the road on the RSS feed, make sure you subscribe on whatever podcast application you're on and leave us a 5-star rating, leave us a review. It definitely helps with a lot of things. We're getting ready to do these credits. You know, this podcast is produced by Blitz Entertainment, Dead and Mellow, toasted and produced by me, Dan Bublitz Jr., Josh Jurley. The theme song, Nobody Had a Podcast Called The Art of Bombing, was done by my good friend John Holt. Our stand-up soundbite bumper was provided by Joe Nicola Music, and all other music and audio was royalty-free or used with permission. Make sure you go to artofbombingpod.com or follow us on all social media platforms at artofbombingpod. Thank you so much for tuning in.
This has been brought to you by Dead and Mellow. Follow us on all your social media platforms and shop around at deadandmellow.com to see all of our stand-up, music, and podcast releases. Thank you, and God bless America.
All right, see you later.
See you.
Are we actually leaving or just...